program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, Environmental Internationalism is in its Flop Era, by Zoe Schlanger. This year is set to break the record for the hottest year ever recorded. It was a banner year for climate devastation. Southern Africa and South America suffered under severe droughts. Dangerous heat bore down on large parts of Asia, Europe, and Central America. And an alarming number of wildfires consumed more than 1 million hectares in Brazil. Hurricanes intensified by abnormally hot seawater pummeled the Caribbean and the American Southeast, and floods deluged parts of Africa and Europe. The Arctic tundra, once a sink for carbon emissions, is officially thawed and sufficiently wildfire-prone to become a source of them. Despite all of that, this year in international environmental diplomacy went exceptionally badly. Inflation and cost of living crises, coupled with a rightward shift in politics in many countries, meant that negotiating for major environmental spending this year was poised to be difficult. But environmental diplomacy has also reached a hard new crossroads. The science of ecological destruction is settled, the trajectory is bleak, and the need for change is obvious. All that's left to do is decide who should deal with it. The diplomatic season began with Colombia hosting the 16th United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity in October. That meeting seeks to staunch the loss of ecosystems and species across the world. Colombia is one of the most biodiverse countries on Earth, and its leftist president is keen on weaning the country off fossil fuels and reducing deforestation. But even with Colombia's motivated leadership, the conference ended in disappointment, as the gathered nations failed to agree on how biodiversity conservation targets would be monitored or paid for. In November, more than 170 countries that gathered in Busan, South Korea, for what was meant to be the fifth and final round of UN plastic pollution treaty talks failed to reach a deal. The impasse came down, once again, to who would bear the costs of curtailing the problem. In this case, more than 100 countries wanted measures to curb the production of plastic, rather than just finding new ways to clean up plastic waste. But that would mean jeopardizing the revenue of the plastic-making industry and petroleum-producing countries, including Saudi Arabia and Russia. Plastic is mostly made from oil and gas, pushed against those measures, blocking a deal. The plastic treaty will try again next year. The blockbuster event, however, was the UN's annual climate conference, where the wealthy nations historically responsible for most of the world's carbon emissions were meant to commit real money to fund developing countries' purposes. Economists said they'd need at least $1 trillion a year. As one of the world's biggest carbon emitters, the United States might be expected to be a major contributor to the pool of money dedicated to slowing climate change and mitigate its effects. But the U.S. has always been an unreliable partner in global climate agreements. And Donald Trump's election last month, shortly before the conference began, meant that any financial contribution from the U.S. in the near future was predicted to be $0. That obviously made a lot of the developed countries very concerned to promise numbers that they can't deliver on. Linda Kalcher, the executive director of the European climate think tank Strategic Perspectives, told me, "Some of the donor countries are in the middle of an inflation and cost of living crises," she noted. In the end, the countries agreed to just $300 billion in climate finance a year by 2035, a fraction of the necessary total. Beyond the U.S., far-right populist parties are gaining footholds in Europe, and they're inclined to frame climate finance as, quote, money that's been donated to other countries at the cost of not renovating your schools, end quote, Kalcher said. It's really a difficult political setting for the big project of climate internationalism. The UN climate negotiations need countries that benefit from fossil fuels to sign onto agreements too. But in recent years, their influence has slowed progress enough that some observers have argued that the whole process is breaking. Energy lobbyists are now always on the conference's roster. Al Gore has called setting these meetings in petrostates, such as the United Arab Emirates and Azerbaijan, absurd. During this year's negotiations, a group that included former diplomacy leaders sent a letter to the UN urging it to reform key aspects of the negotiations, including who is allowed to attend. Kalcher, who has worked as a senior advisor to the UN Secretary General on climate issues, said she still believes in the process. After all, no other venue exists where countries can hash out deals on climate matters, and the least developed, most climate-stricken ones have a seat at the table with the industrial behemoths. But for right now, climate internationalism is in a sorry state. Arguably, the project of environmental internationalism has reached the most difficult part of the problems it's been tasked with. The main question left to answer is who should pay to stave off the worst of climate change's ravages. When climate negotiations started more than 30 years ago, the science of climate change had begun to resolve some of the most important uncertainties about the planet's future. Now science has produced broad consensus on the cause and general trajectory of climate change. It's a simple fact that many countries will flounder without major funding from wealthy countries and suffer enormous consequences from climate changes they did not cause. Prior eras of climate diplomacy were focused on hammering out the basic contours of the climate problem and agreeing that it must be addressed. Now the world is at the point where meaningfully altering the trajectory of ecological decline requires transitioning the world off fossil fuels, which will require fossil fuel economies to radically change. Likewise, protecting biodiversity will require major changes to an economic system that values industries such as tourism and timber more than mangroves and rainforests. And curbing plastics will require curbing plastic production, an industry now deeply embedded in almost every aspect of global commerce and tied to the system of subsidies and state support for fossil fuels. One way or another, addressing these problems will require deep economic reforms. Of course, making them could ensure the future habitability of the planet, which comes with its own obvious economic benefits. A few glimmers of hope for environmental diplomacy do remain. In the final weeks of his presidency, Joe Biden is pushing forward an agreement in which the U.S. and the 37 other well-off countries at the OECD would effectively stop using their export credit agencies to fund fossil fuel projects overseas. This decision would deprive the fossil fuel economy of one source of backing and eliminate one of the only remaining ways that the U.S. government supports international oil and gas development. It would change nothing about the U.S.'s position as the world's largest current producer of oil and exporter of gas, but it would potentially eliminate billions of dollars in future funding for such projects overseas. And, unlike financial commitments made at the UN Climate Conference, this decision would put rules in place that proponents say would be hard for the incoming Trump administration to undo. It would be a step toward a modicum of climate safety. The world will meet again next year in Belém, Brazil, for the 30th iteration of the UN Climate Talks. By then, Trump will be in office and will have likely started the process to withdraw the U.S. from the climate bargaining table. The past year's paltry outcome will surely cast a shadow over relations between developed and undeveloped countries, the most imperiled of which view the weak finance deal as a betrayal of trust. China, the world's largest current emitter of greenhouse gases, as well as the largest producer of clean energy technology, may step into the vacuum of power the U.S. will have left behind, or it may not. Other major oil-producing countries, emboldened by the withdrawal of the Americans, may dilute whatever show of climate solidarity they've previously made. This impasse comes when warming is accelerating faster in some areas even than scientists expected, and the physical threats it poses are reaching dangerous new heights of severity. But global diplomacy remains the world's best idea to address a global problem. Countries will still come together, and they will try to make some progress, because for many of them in desperate climate straits, there is simply no other choice. Either we figure this out, or we live with the consequences. Next, 6 binge-worthy movie series. Few things are better than staying in on a Sunday afternoon and putting on a good movie, or 2 or 3. 6 of The Atlantic's writers and editors provide their answer to the question, what is your favorite movie series to binge? The Mission Impossible series. Watching 7 whole movies may sound like a difficult binge, but marathoning the Mission Impossible films is, well, a mission I'll always accept. They're pure popcorn entertainment, and watching them is a far easier task than anything Tom Cruise's super spy character has had to do. Across the almost 30-year-old franchise, with another entry coming next year, Ethan Hunt has prevented a pandemic and a nuclear war, taken down multiple arms dealers and terrorist organization leaders, and, in what remains my favorite gag, donned a series of ridiculous and impressively realistic masks. Part of the joy of watching the Mission Impossible movies in one sitting is seeing what each director does with the material. Brad Bird, known for his animation work, brings a delightfully kinetic energy to Ghost Protocol, while the Hong Kong auteur John Woo prefers hypnotic slow-motion shots in Mission Impossible 2. Of course, the biggest draw remains Cruise's dedication to performing his own stunts, whether it's leaping out of an airplane or dangling off the side of a skyscraper. Ethan Hunt may work to save the world, but Tom Cruise works to dazzle us, and in these movies, he never fails. That was written by Shirley Lee, staff writer. The Back to the Future trilogy. I'm going to cheat on this question slightly because my favorite movies are almost entirely one-offs, and I usually save my binge-watching for sports. But as movie series go, a somewhat underappreciated one is Back to the Future. The original is a family classic. I watched it the first time at a theater as a teenager with my boomer parents, precisely the generational targets for the movie's time travel humor. The sequels probe the twisted psyche of Biff Tannen, a misogynistic oligarch in one of the alternate futures and one of my personal favorite movie villains. The actor, Tom Wilson, also later played a much more complex and sympathetic version of a bully as the gym teacher on Freaks and Geeks. Tying together the films is a series of front-page stories in the Hill Valley Telegraph, a fictional newspaper with news judgments so strange that I once wrote a column analyzing it. Although the sequels, like most sequels, pale against the original, they each explore the question, what would you do if you traveled back in time and possessed modern knowledge? The answer is basically, invent things, gamble on sports, and try to score dates with Leah Thompson. That was written by Jonathan Chait, staff writer. 3, The Lord of the Rings trilogy. There's no wrong time to watch The Lord of the Rings trilogy, but the winter holidays are the perfect time. These fantasy classics introduce you to the wonders of Middle-earth, replete with its own histories, languages, and mythologies, and J.R.R. Tolkien's characters. Aragorn and his sharp pride, Frodo and his understated courage, Gimli and his uncouth charm. The book swept me away as a child, and Peter Jackson's rendition more than does them justice. That's in part because the films run roughly 3 hours each. 4, if you watch the extended cuts, which I recommend. Jackson needed every minute to unfold a number of intertwining, tension-filled plots, battles, friendships, and romances. The movie's lengths are something to luxuriate in, perfect for cozy December and January evenings. Indeed, they each debuted in theaters on the third Wednesday of December. You could even tack on the more recent live-action Hobbit trilogy, but I'd actually opt for the much shorter 1977 animated version, which perfectly captures the novel's appeal to children. That was written by Mateo Wong, also a staff writer. 4. High School Musical Trilogy. In the first installment of the High School Musical series, our protagonists, Troy, a 5'8" basketball star, and Gabriella, a girl who is both pretty and good at math, accidentally auditioned for the school musical and destabilized their high school's social order. The Disney plotline is predictably unrealistic, but real problems poke their way in. The high school arts department is struggling. Troy's dad can be mean. Figuring out who you are is hard when your classmates sing in unison about where you belong. The sequel is an ultra-saturated fever dream. A group of high schoolers get summer jobs at a country club. Troy sings an anxious rock anthem while running across an entire golf course. No notes. Then the finale. I saw High School Musical 3 in theaters when I was 8. Years later, I still appreciate how the film captures the bittersweet celebration of senior year and the stress of figuring out what happens after the curtain falls. If you decide to make this series your next movie binge, watch for the nostalgia and stay for the standout musical numbers. Everyone, say thank you to the director, Kenny Ortega, who also choreographed Michael Jackson's stage tours. This opinion written by Hannah Kiros, an assistant editor. The Indiana Jones Trilogy. I want to emphasize trilogy. The fourth Indiana Jones film suffers from too much Shia LaBeouf, and the fifth was an instantly forgettable CGI fest. But Raiders of the Lost Ark and its two sequels have retained their magic. Harrison Ford's relentlessly physical performance deserves much of the credit. His Indiana Jones is a paragon of 20th century American masculinity. He is a scholar, but not in an affected European way. This is a man who can keep a lion at bay with a whip, outdo a tank on horseback, and land knockout punches on all manner of Nazis. The movies are dated in their depictions of certain cultures. Temple of Doom, which follows Jones on an adventure in India, is marred by unseemly Orientalism. But they still offer viewers a powerful escapism. In just the first hours of Raiders, we're whisked off to the Peruvian jungle, a snowy Himalayan saloon, and sun-baked streets of Cairo. The ancient artifacts that Jones seeks adds another layer of fantasy. They ask us to envision lost worlds, often through a mystical lens, and they do it all without slowing down the pace for even a single second. Written by Ross Anderson. And the sixth, the Before Trilogy. My favorite movie series is also the only movie series I've seen, Richard Linklater's Before Trilogy. I'm not a huge fan of romance movies, but these three magical films stand apart from others with near-identical premises. I watched the first, Before Sunrise, during a boring weekend in my 20s, which turned out to be the perfect time to watch a movie about two adrift 20-somethings, played by Julie Deppi and Ethan Hawke, wandering around Vienna and falling in love. I followed that up soon afterward with the second, Before Sunset, which features the same exact actors, this time as 30-somethings, wandering around Paris and re-falling in love. For some reason, merely swapping the cities and ages works so well. Not long after that, in 2013, Linklater released the final installment, Before Midnight, which I saw in theaters. This one had a harder edge. The two main characters, now a couple, wrestle with parenting, career woes, and other adult concerns, but it's still impossible to take your eyes off of them. What is it that makes these 5 hours of two people talking so captivating? Is it Linklater's gift for realistic dialogue, or is it that we all wish we had met our husband on a European train in 1994? It's hard to say, but easy to watch. That was written by Olga Kazan. Next, an opinion piece by Connor Friedersdorf. How to move on from the worst of identity politics. Donald Trump's 2024 victory was about much more than a backlash to left identity politics. Inflation, among other matters, loomed large. Still, Trump gained significant ground with Latino, Black, Asian, Arab, Gen Z, and big city voters. And that, as much as Kamala Harris's loss, has spurned Democrats to reconsider the role that identity politics plays in their coalition. Identity politics need to go the way of the dodo, Alyssa Slotkin, who just won a Senate race in Michigan, said in a meeting of fellow Democrats. Identity politics did not work electorally, and it failed miserably strategically, Rahm Emanuel told Politico. This is a significant shift. At the height of the Great Awakening, as white liberals moved to the left of the typical Black voter on questions of race and racism, a faction of progressive intellectuals persuaded themselves that identity politics was the future of liberalism. They had noble intentions. They saw persistent inequalities in society, felt frustrated that change wasn't happening faster, and so advocated for more and more radical measures to fix what they perceived as injustices, and they changed the Democratic Party. Kamala Harris was one of the politicians who appeared to embrace their narrative in ways that would haunt her later in her run for the presidency. Most Americans agree with progressives that racism and sexism are still problems, but supporters of identity politics were mistaken in assuming they would be the same majority would sign on to pursuing equity instead of equality. And so there is promise in a reckoning. It is necessary to get the Democratic Party back in sync with everyday voters. There's a real risk of overcorrecting, the Illinois State Representative Cam Buchner warned in a recent opinion article. Without a thorough critique of what went wrong and a thoughtful path forward, we could end up discarding an essential tool for connection and understanding. Democrats need a guiding principle. The most promising is equal treatment. The progressive identitarian attack on equal treatment is explicit and radical in its implications. In a 2020 Vox essay that championed the identity politics, Zach Beauchamp favorably quoted the late philosopher Iris Marion Young. She argued that the specificity of each group requires a specific set of rights for each, and for some a more comprehensive system than for others. In Beauchamp's retelling, identity politics was both the savior and the future of American liberalism, and the true equality demands treating groups differently rather than the same. But treating groups differently is politically unsustainable. Try telling a diverse group of Americans who gets the best treatment, who gets middling treatment, and who will be treated worst. Most Americans prefer a universalist vision. True equality demands treating people the same, regardless of their identity group. So no segregated diners, no firing an employee for being gay, no stop and frisks that racially profile Black pedestrians, and no college admission officers who malign Asian American applicants. A useful reckoning would reaffirm equal treatment and its basic corollaries. For example, stop maligning whole identity groups and treat all group discrimination as both irrational and wrong. But even as the populist right ramped up its corrosive rhetoric, the identitarian left was violating similar norms against multiple groups. During Trump's first term, Harvard was caught assigning lower personality scores to Asian American applicants. Joe Biden declared in 2020 that black Americans unsure about voting for him ain't black. In a secretly recorded 2020 meeting, Los Angeles City Council members denigrated black people while discussing how to shore up Latino political power at the expense of black Angelinos. After the October 7th attacks, some Jewish college students and faith-based organizations were targets of anti-Israel activists simply because of their Jewishness. Much as Republicans once paid a price when Rush Limbaugh made offensive comments about women, Democrats pay a price when prominent individuals and institutions associated with its coalition heap scorn on a large group of voters. And regardless of the electoral prospects of the Democratic Party, trafficking in sweeping negative stereotypes about any identity group is wrong and contagious. Politically speaking, equality demands treating groups differently is a losing message. In California, one of the most progressive states in the country, voters decided that college admission should be race blind in 1996. Progressives tried to bring back differential treatment in 2020, and California voters rejected racial preferences again by an even wider margin. In 2019, Pew Research Center asked if employers should consider an applicant's race and ethnicity in hiring and promotions, or consider their qualifications exclusively, even if it results in less diversity. 74% of respondents favored considering qualifications alone. To do good for the country and to perform better in the upcoming elections, Democrats don't need to abandon identity politics entirely. Their coalition can celebrate Pride and Black History Month, object to Muslim bans, urge corporations to recruit from racially and ethnically diverse applicant pools, and more, so long as it also rejects the party's least popular, most harmful identity politics excesses. If Democrats renounce identitarian stereotyping and discrimination, their coalition will benefit, and America will too. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.